Hey there, podcast listener. In order to keep our show free to download, we have to remove the full versions of the songs that we listen to during the interviews. But if you want to hear this episode in its entirety, go to threesongstories.org or just download the WGCU app to your phone and find us there.
One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the podcast that creates biography using the songs that have touched our guests' lives. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for listening. My guest this episode is Nathan Hill. He's a writer and author of the 2016 best-selling novel, The Knicks. He moved to Naples in 2006 from New York City to take a job as professor at FGCU. Did that till 2012, moved away for a couple of years, then got his book deal, so moved back to Naples to focus on his writing. Nathan grew up all over the Midwest, where his grandparents had worked as farmers. His family moved constantly as his father worked his way up through management at Kmart. When he agreed to do this show, it delighted me because I couldn't wait to see how a novelist, a literal professional teller of stories, would respond to this Three Song Stories concept. And seems like now I shall wait no more. Hey there, Nathan Hill.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for being here. Well, let's start with basics. What was the musical background of your childhood when you were growing up in the Midwest?
Music was the point of contention between us kids and the parents.
Oh,
so
okay.
I have two little sisters. Music wasn't on in the house all that much, to be honest. I suspect my dad was into music at some point in his life because he did have this old and really awesome like stereo and turntable system that had like, you know, he had all these like Three Dog Night records. But it's apparently sometime in when I was a toddler, I ruined that thing by accidentally turning the volume way too loud.
So he blew his sound system?
I blew his sound system. I don't think he ever had the heart to replace it. So music wasn't on too much in the house, but whenever we would take a road trip, music would be our companion the entire time. And so, as you mentioned, we moved around a lot, and so we would always travel back to Iowa to see the family at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. And so we'd make the 8-hour journey by car, you know, the three kids in the back, the parents in front. And of course, the kids, we wanted to listen to good music, which at the time meant like Def Leppard, AC/DC, Bon Jovi.
What era would this
be? Oh, that would have been the, you know, mid-80s,
okay.
You know. My parents wanted to listen to what us kids thought was the terrible music, which meant, you know, Jim Croce, Simon Garfunkel, Bread. They had this one cassette tape called The Best of Bread that we actually literally hid before a road trip so we wouldn't have to listen.
I don't even think I know Bread. How did I miss Bread?
Go listen to the song Everything I Own. It's a very sweet ballad that now is just fused with nostalgia and warm feelings for me. But when I was 8, I hated it.
Yeah.
It wasn't really on in the house that much. My parents didn't play a musical instrument, but they encouraged us kids to. And so in the fourth or fifth grade, I started playing the trumpet. And I did that for a while until we moved to rural Oklahoma when I was in eighth grade. And the school that I attended was so small it didn't have a band. It couldn't support it. So my parents found a guy who was like studying jazz trumpet at like the local community college to give me lessons. And in the first lesson, he said, okay, I'm going to teach you jazz. I said, okay. And so he put down some notes and he's like, okay, play these notes. And I played the notes. And he's like, okay, now jazz it up a little. And I kind of looked at him like, what do you mean?
I have no context for this.
And yeah, and he's like, just, you know, don't play the notes, play around the notes. And so I took my best eighth grade stab at it, and then he just kind of looked at me and he's like, okay, do that again, but just try to do it better. You know?
Sounds like he was a great teacher.
I blamed myself at the time. Looking back on it, yes, you're right. He was a terrible teacher. So I ended up giving up trumpet, never to return to it. But that was music in childhood. It was a lot of car rides and my trumpet sometimes squealing occasionally.
Were the car rides musically powered by tapes, or were you listening to the radio?
Oh, it was tapes. Yeah, for sure. It was always tapes. The country that we were driving through could not always be counted on to get good radio reception.
If you had to try to dig deep into your memory for like a first musical memory, can you think of something that would pop up from early on that just one of those things that crystallized for you?
Like way early, I'd say Like, I remember Michael Jackson videos,
You
know? Like, I remember, like, watching these things. And maybe it was, like, it was the thrill of doing something I don't think my mom wanted me to, you know, to do. So, like, I saw the Thriller video and all these, like, dancing zombies with these, like, this, like, purple goo jelly coming out of their mouths, you know?
Yeah,
or,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Or Beat It. You remember Beat It?
Oh, yeah.
And as a kid kind of growing up in the Midwestern suburbs, I thought Beat It was, like, some warning of an apocalyptic inner city, you know, dystopia.
I could see that.
So I remember that. And then of course there was my stadium rock phase in the 80s when I actually really did get into music in a big way. And I fell in love with, you know, Def Leppard, AC/DC, Bon Jovi, Motley Crue. Oh my goodness. I remember listening to Dr. Feelgood by Motley Crue and listening to a one part very, very slowly because there was this rumor that if you listen to this one part in that song backwards, you could hear the satanic messages. And that was during those days when, like, the worst things parents had to worry about was Satanism, which weirdly seems kind of quaint now, doesn't it?
How times have changed.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite song to sing? And does the answer to that question change if I add when nobody's around?
Well, I have a terrible singing voice. It's just awful. I cannot carry a tune. And so if I'm forced to sing out loud in front of people, I always tend towards Bob Dylan, because, you know, you can kind of get away with a lot with a Dylan song. And most of those Dylan songs, like, you know, everybody wants to sing along with you. So you end up, like, being in a chorus anyway. So
right.
my awful lack of
– It's a place for you to hide your voice.
Yeah, exactly. My lack of talent is camouflaged. If nobody's around, what do I like to sing? Oh, gosh. I'd say I love U2. I love Bono. My wife and I get into fights about Bono. She's
not a Bono fan.
She's not. She's a classically trained classical musician. You know, she was a singer for a long time, and she doesn't like the growl in his voice. She always says he's going to injure himself singing that way. And I'm like, well, he's been doing it for a long time.
So far so good.
So if nobody's listening, I will sing U2 songs because then she can't be pissed off.
What was the first music you owned? That was yours.
The first music I owned was a CD, probably. Oh, no. It was a tape. It was the Beastie Boys, License to Ill.
Nice,
yeah.
Nice.
And I remember buying it because asking my dad to buy it for me,
yeah.
And he did, not knowing what it was. And then he listened to me listening to it, like, through the bedroom door. And he came in and he's like, is that tape that I bought you? And I said, yeah. And he's like, you didn't tell me it was rap. And he immediately took it back to the store.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
He returned it?
He returned it. I was not allowed to own the Beastie Boys.
Wow. When you got up in the world as an individual human being, did you repurchase License to Ill?
Or? Oh, I did, of course, yeah. And now, of course, I have, like, Spotify. So I guess I own all Beastie Boys,
right.
Technically.
Do you have a favorite band?
I would probably say, oh goodness, I would probably say Radiohead would be my favorite. Although I'm awful, I've never actually even seen them live, so I'm hardly a good fan, I guess.
Well, let's pivot from that sentiment to your first song. What are we gonna play?
We're gonna play "Paranoid Android" by Radiohead from their amazing album OK Computer.
Do you want to set this song up with some of a story, all of a story, or would you like to just hear the song and then come out of it with your
story?
I'll
set it up a little bit. This came out almost 21 years ago, exactly, in May of 1997. For a little context, I had just started college. I went to the University of Iowa, and when I arrived there, I was majoring in biomedical engineering. Yeah.
It's a straight line right to novelist.
Exactly. I had always been a writer. I'd always loved writing, and I'd always been a reader. But my parents were very, very much thought that that was a horrible idea. That you know, I was going to go to college. I was among the first in my family to do that, and they didn't want me to waste an opportunity like college on studying something like the arts. So they're like, "Why don't you study something that will make you a lot of money, and then you can try writing on the side?" And so I was under that influence for a little while. And when this song came out, when this album came out, I had just sort of made a sort of epiphany. I had been taking these creative writing classes at the University of Iowa, which turns out has a pretty good writing mm-hmm. program. And I loved them. I didn't even know you could study creative writing. I didn't know that was an option. And so I started taking these classes, and eventually I was spending more time with those classes than I was with my engineering studies. And I had a guidance counselor in engineering who told me, you have to stop taking these English classes or else you're not going to graduate on time. So I said, well, screw this. And I dumped engineering and picked up English and picked up creative writing. And so this song came out about exactly that time when I was making this transition from the sciences into the arts and to pursue this somewhat kind of risky career, but also one that where my heart was really, really kind of dying to pursue it.
All right. Well, this is Paranoid Android by Radiohead. It's Nathan Hill's first song on this episode of Three Song Stories. So what is it about that song that crystallized it into your memories during that time to the point that we're talking about it and listening to it today?
Yeah, I remember when I first heard this song. I remember being at a party at the house of this guy who had really good musical taste, and he said that he had to put this album on and everybody's got to listen to it, which with this particular guy and his particular parties usually was code for like, let's pretend there's a more noble reason for the drugs we're about to do.
Yeah.
but he put the album on and offered no drugs whatsoever, and we all just actually sat there sincerely listening soberly to this album.
The music was the drug.
Yeah. And we were all like, what in the world is this? For a little more context, I had to look this up, but like the number one song in the on the Billboard Top 40 the week that OK Computer dropped was Bop by Hanson.
Oh, that puts it into context.
Yeah. Other artists on the chart that week, there was a lot of Spice Girls. There was some Jewel. There was some Toni Braxton. There was some R. Kelly. There was some
Jewel,
En Vogue.
Yeah. I haven't thought of.
Yeah. So like so then Radiohead comes into this. I've read that Radiohead's studio dropped their sales estimates when they actually heard the album, because OK Computer was nothing like anything that was popular at the moment. But as you just heard, it's moody, it's atmospheric, it's layered. I felt like the lyrics were like giving us news from the future, you know, like.
And here we are.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's like this world. The whole album is about this world of like technological isolation and paranoia and social anxiety,
and
which
here
turns
we are.
Out,
yeah.
But also there was I don't know, it lined up really well with my artistic mood at the time. I was a young man trying to be a real artist, and I was writing
and trying to break free from engineering.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, I was writing these like dark and grisly stories that I knew nothing about. I was writing, you know, about, you know, horrible abuse and murder and all these terrible things. And you know, I grew up very pleasant childhood in the suburbs. Like I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, you weren't writing what you know.
Exactly.
You were writing what you thought you should write.
Exactly. And yeah. But this like this album and this song, it's so dark and strange and mysterious. It kind of felt like what I wanted to do and wasn't able yet to do. There's this – Ira Glass has this great quote about how artists of really any discipline they all have to go through this phase where your talent has to catch up with your taste, you know. I knew that Radiohead was doing something very special, but I couldn't quite do that yet. I needed a lot more practice to kind of get there, but they were like a lighthouse on the horizon for me, if that makes sense.
How are your parents today with your choice of the arts?
It was really very selfishly pleasant for me to be able to say I told you so when I sold the book. Yeah, but to be fair, they're really excited for me. I mean, they were proud. I mean, I taught for a very long time. I was a professor, and they were very,
and that's legitimate.
Yeah, exactly. They're very proud of me, and I worked in journalism for a long time before that. So I think they were worried that I'd go into English and then move back into their basement, which never happened. So it all turned out okay.
Did you ever make mixtapes?
I did make mixtapes and then later mix CDs.
What was your process for the mixtapes? Was it for you? Was it for your friends? Was it for potential interests?
When I first started doing it, it was almost like a performance piece. I would pretend that I was a radio disc jockey, and I
voicing
would,
and all,
voicing and all. Wow. And so I would like record myself doing the thing, and then I would introduce a song.
That's
and then
a
the
first,
song would
by
play.
The way, in is these
that,
interviews.
Is that right? Yeah. And so, and then I just kept them. I didn't play them for anybody. They were just for me. You know, it was just pretend.
But, did you play them for you?
Yeah, I would play them for
you
me.
You at least would play them back once.
Yeah,
you wouldn't that'd be weird.
Yeah, it would. Somewhere there's a box of like me doing this.
To
also
you.
Listen to.
did anybody ever make you a mixtape?
Huh. I don't think so. I know that when I was wooing the woman who is now my wife, I did make her several mix CDs. And that was really great. And hopefully helpful. She like I said, she's a classical musician, and so she that whole time in college where you kind of, you know, listen to a lot of popular, maybe not so popular music, she was in a studio practicing, so she kind of missed all that. So I was like filling her in. Huh. This is what happened in music for the last 8 years.
Any songs you can remember from those CDs that you made for? You know, it's like Whitney Houston.
Oh well, no, this was later. This was around early 2000.
You still could have been listening.
And this will be another perfect segue because one of the songs was "New York, New York" by Ryan Adams.
Oh really?
Yeah, it was.
Well, I was going to ask you a few more questions. Before we get to that,
okay.
Which we will get to in a second, let's talk about the song that almost made your list, the fourth song. Was there a fourth? Or was it easy to identify three? What was close?
There's this song that I saw – So sometimes after concerts down at the Philharmonic in Naples, sometimes a lot of the musicians will go bowling. It's just a you know,
there you have it.
Let off some steam. Go bowling, and so I'll go bowling with them. And one night, you know, it's like midnight in the bowling alley. It's like neon lights and music videos playing above all the alleys. And one night, this music video came on. And we were all just sort of transfixed. And the song was called "Bass Down Low" by Dev. It's not a very popular song. I encourage everybody to listen to it because I challenge you to tell me what it's about. Like, I really have no idea. It's a song that has a really ambiguous relationship with meaning. But it's just – it seems to be about a woman –
purposefully so?
Yeah,
or did somebody miss the mark?
Yeah, no. It seems to be like this woman sort of seems to like bass. But like, is bass for code? Like code for something? Like, you know, like Meghan Trainor? I don't know. It's just she seems to like her bass down low, and I'm not sure what that means. Maybe it means something. I'm just too old to know. But we all just loved it so much, and it's got such a kind of goofy music video that we started playing it at first, ironically, all the time, and then
we
slowly,
meaning you and your wife,
me and my wife, and all of our friends.
Okay.
And then slowly we started playing
anthem.
It, playing it unironically, playing it sincerely. And then it started showing up like – and then we all, you know, we all got married and it played at every one of our weddings, you know. And like eventually, you know, like at a wedding, the crowd filters out and it's just like the good friends who are left.
Yeah,
and
the core is left.
That's when everybody would play Bass Down Low and we would all reenact that night from the bowling alley when after a pitcher or two of cheap beer, we all danced to this weird song.
When was the last time you listened to it with people?
Oh,
or
goodness.
Just in general?
With people, I have no idea. Probably the last wedding, which was now about a year and a half ago.
Okay. Well, now let's get back to the perfect segue that you set up before.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So we're going to hear this is New York, New York by Ryan Adams. Do you want to talk about it first? Do you want to listen to it first? Do you choose?
I'll set up a little bit. So this is – it's 2001 now when this song comes out. It was released on his album Gold. And I have just moved to the East Coast. I spent several years in Iowa City. After I graduated, I worked as a newspaper reporter for a few years. But I always knew that I wanted to be a fiction writer. And so I decided to apply to MFA programs in creative writing. writing. And I only applied to East Coast and West Coast schools. I lived in the Midwest my entire
life. You were done with the middle.
I love it there, but I just wanted to see something new, you know. And I got into to the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I started in September 2001, which is exactly when this album came out. So this is sort of – it's funny. Like when I was growing up, music was oh gosh, I listened to what everybody else listened to, you know,
right.
the you know, Bon Jovi in the 80s or in the 90s. I was a big fan of the alternative stuff that all the angsty teens were into, Pearl Jam, Nirvana, you know.
The plaid.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a lot of flannel and combat boots. So I listened to what everybody else listened to, and I moved to the East Coast in 2001, and suddenly I was with very artsy people who spent quality time in Brooklyn. And suddenly I realized that music wasn't really about group cohesion anymore. It was it was about like individuation.
Yeah.
You know, it was about like proving your bona fides because you listen to the right bands. One of the bands that people listened to at that time was this guy Ryan Adams. But of course, you couldn't like Ryan Adams now. You had to like him way back when he was the lead singer of Whiskey Town, because that's the only way you were actually an authentic fan. So I felt like I had some catching up to do. So I started listening to all the acts that seemed to have, you know, credibility with the tastemakers I was suddenly surrounded by, and so Ryan Adams was one of them.
All right. Well, this is New York, New York by Ryan Adams. You're listening to Three Song Stories. It's biography through music.
Well, I shuffled through the city on a 4th of July. Had a firecracker waiting to blow, breaking like a rifle who was making his way to the cities of Mexico. Lived in an apartment out on Avenue A, had a tar on a corner of town. Had myself a lover who was finer than gold, but I've been broken, I've been busted up since. Love don't play any games with me anymore like she did before.
How much time had you spent in the Northeast and in New York City in particular prior to moving up there?
Very, very little. I had an internship in Connecticut the year before my last year in college. It was an unpaid summer gig writing for a magazine, an environmental magazine. And I took the train. My first week there, I took the train down to New York City, and it was the first time I'd ever been there. I had a love affair with New York City from afar for a very long time.
Hadn't smelled it yet, though.
No, I hadn't. You know, the burning peanut vendors, you know? And the sulfur from the grates where the subways are running. Yeah, I don't know. It was one of those things. Like, you know, I kind of grew up wanting to be a writer, and yeah, I don't know. Maybe I read too much, you know, Jack Kerouac or Truman Capote, but I just thought moving to New York City is the thing that young writers need to do, you know, so I moved out to the Northeast to go to UMass in the autumn of 2001, and that's when this song came out. So it always reminds me of that moment.
Autumn of 2001, so that's right around.
Exactly. Yeah. So weirdly, the music video for this song features the World Trade Center very prominently, and that music video came out the morning of September 11, 2001. It's just a weird coincidence, yeah. And I understand that Ryan Adams stopped playing this song for a while because it was all
tied up with
9/11. But it also also kind of caught that love affair that happened to New York City in the years after 9/11. So of course I have that association with it, and I was in school for what, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before 9/11 happened, and you know, I still had ties to journalism outlets back in Iowa. My old newspaper editor asked me, "Will you go to New York City and write a story? Just what do you see? Try to find some Iowans." And so I did. So, you know, the Tuesday after 9/11, 9/11 happened on a Tuesday, maybe the Thursday after 9/11. I think I'm right about that. Please don't check if you're listening to that.
we try to be fact-based, but we're not too hung up on it.
You know, it's been a long time. But anyway, the point is, a few days after 9/11, I took the train into the city and walked around, and it was so emotional and so heartbreaking, and wrote my story. So that's the sad association I have with this song. But I also have a very happy association with this song too, because for the next year or so that I was at UMass, I mean, we would go down into Manhattan all the time. We'd go to New York all the time. And then the places that he sings about in this song, you know, like dive bars on the Lower East Side, that was my life, you know, during this time. I was going to readings at the KGB bar in Lower Manhattan and then going into Alphabet City to drink really cheap PBR with my friends, you know. And this was
you
my
were a
life.
Hipster before they were cool.
I don't know. I don't know. I was following hipsters, you know. I had friends who were hipsters and
right.
I was in their circle because I was in their writing classroom. And that was, I don't know, it had never felt so proximate to me, you know. And so this song, which is just a love letter to New York City, really captures kind of what I felt at that time, which is this is for me, you know. I'd been dreaming about the city, you know, growing up, and finally I was here, and I was like, you know, as soon as I'm done with school, this is where I'm going to end up.
So when did you you mentioned that this song wound up on a mix CD you made for your wife or your future wife, or kind of tie that together. When did you meet her? How much longer after this song, and why, you know?
We started dating when I was in grad school. So I think after my first – beginning of my second year of grad school, we started dating. So that would have been 2002. And she had just gotten a job down here with the Naples Philharmonic. And so we were long distance for a very long time. I would come down to Naples. She would come up to Amherst. So it was around that time that I made those mix CDs for her. We were very new. We were wooing each other. Mm-hmm. I was like, look how cool I am. Here's all my good, you know, my great taste in music that you don't know, you know. So that was part of that. And of course, we had talked about me moving down to Naples or her moving up to New York City after I graduated from grad school. And I decided that I needed to have that New York experience. You know, I didn't want to move to Naples immediately. So I ended up moving to New York. And so we were away from each other. We were in long distance for what, 4 years?
Wow.
Before we ever lived in the same place.
You probably get to go to New York quite a bit these days, right?
These days I do. Yeah. Whether it's you know, meeting with my editor or just visiting friends. I'm
living the life. So musically today, where are you at? What do you listen to? Do you just stream? Do you listen to the radio? Like, what's your musical stylings today?
It's quite boring, honestly. I have my Spotify account, and I'll just kind of listen to what it tells me to. it's funny. In some ways, I appreciate that because I get all this I hear all these new songs. But in another way, I sort of miss the days where you had to like buy an album and then you just listen to the album start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
With Spotify, I never do that. You know, I sample, I dive in and dive out. It makes mixtapes for me, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just algorithms. It's not an actual human trying to woo me. You know, it feels less less warm. At least it feels more cold.
You know, it's not a perfect analogy or comparison, but it's interesting that you say that. Because, you know, I don't know if artists think to make – or musicians think to make, you know, arcs of albums as much anymore because of the way we consume music. And it would almost be like selling a novel by chapter.
Yeah. Well, you can you know, you're able to dive in and out of an album, I suppose, but and not lose too much of the context. But there are certain albums that I think – you know, do work as a whole. I think of like, you know, Beyonce's Lemonade. You know, I think is one of those, like, it's an event in itself. You know, I think what was that Taylor Swift concept album, 1989? Is that what that was called?
You've gone beyond my depth of knowledge.
But it was her album before her latest album, and it was this kind of interesting exercise in like modernizing a sort of 80s style of album. You know, so I think you have to go really concept, you know, to have an entire album that's worth listening to in its totality. Otherwise, yeah, people kind of come in and out via Spotify or iTunes or what have you.
Do you have a band that you like that you think the listeners would never have heard of? Do you have anything that's sort of an off the beaten path choice in music?
There's this band called the Budos Band that I just started listening to, and it's just kind of it's just like a lot of like big drum beats and baritone saxophones, you know? Yeah,
it's Budos?
Budos, B-U-D-O-S.
B-U-D-O-S.
And there's no lyrics. It's just like this hard driving beat, but it sounds like, I don't know, it sounds like it has, you know, a lot of influences. Music from Mexico and Africa seem to be blended in together with this like really kind of incredible incredible horn section, and it's just very cool.
How'd you find it?
Spotify.
Yeah. Well, maybe there is somebody out there curating.
Maybe. Thank you, Spotify.
Do you listen to music when you're writing?
I listen to music that does not have lyrics.
So something like that would be something you might put on?
Well, that's actually a little too hard. I tend to restrict myself to kind of light piano solos mostly, or Yo-Yo Ma is a good choice, like when he's playing cello, like Bach cello suites, you know. But can't have music. It's even opera, even if the – or sorry, I can't have lyrics. Even opera, even if the lyrics are in a foreign language.
That's still...
It's distracting. I need the language to be my own. But I do like to fill the room with something quiet and relaxing and also engaging and complex.
All right. Well, let's turn to your third song. What do you have for us?
I have, and this is an odd selection, maybe, but you'll understand when I tell the story why I chose it. Violin Concerto No. 1 in G Major by Max Bruch. This is Bruch's most famous and actually probably only famous work. Max Bruch was a composer in Germany, kind of turn of the century, late 1800s, and he was the author of nearly 100 pieces of music, 3 symphonies, 3 operas, 16 concertos, you know. But this is the work that everybody remembers him by, and this is really the only work that's still played by Max Bruch, is this violin concerto. But it's played a lot. A few years ago, there's this radio station called Classic FM in London, and they did a top 300 Hall of Fame countdown style thing over Easter weekend, and they asked their listeners to vote on their favorite classical pieces, and Max Bruch came in number 1 and number 300 with nothing in between. Number 1 was this piece we're going to listen to, the Violin Concerto No. 1. Number 300 was the Kol Nidre, and he had nothing in between. So it's like he's like the only composer out there who's incredibly celebrated for just one thing, and this is it.
All right. And this is the version who was it you said?
The soloist here is Joshua Bell. Who's just a brilliant violinist.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Three Song Stories on WGCU. So what's the story behind that one?
Well, so as you can hear from the first movement there, Bruch is writing a very kind of romantic, very beautiful sounding concerto. You know, it's very luscious. It's very it stands in pretty stark contrast to some of the other things that were going on when he was writing.
When was that?
This was in the – oh, goodness. When did he write it? 1860s, I think, okay. I want to say. He was in Germany at the time. Bruch was the anti-Wagner. So Wagner was writing these pieces that were, you know, Wagnerian, you know.
Yeah, I can see it.
and you know, very aggressive sounds, you know, as opposed to the very kind of light touch of Bruch. And Bruch is kind of looking backwards at a more romantic kind of style of writing, inherited from, say, Beethoven. And Wagner is looking ahead to a different style of writing that ultimately finds its sort of genesis in someone like, you know, atonal stuff of like Schoenberg, you know, which must have made Bruch's ears bleed, you know. So he's very much a a traditionalist. He's very much a kind of musically conservative in that way. And he longed to write something that was just gorgeous, that was just beautiful, that was timeless in its beauty. He wasn't interested in the fireworks of Wagner or Schoenberg. He wanted something that's traditionally beautiful. And he did it. I mean, that's it. For my money, those opening lines from the violin are some of the most gorgeous music ever written. The problem is that he did it his first time out. And, you know, it's his concerto number one.
Yeah.
And then he had a whole career and people kept asking him for concerto number one. And yeah. Violinists would continue to want to play concerto number
one. One hit wonder before they were cool.
Yeah, exactly. So even into the early 1900s, he wrote letters to some of his friends. And I brought in a quote because I thought it was hilarious. I think this is 1903. He wrote, "Nothing compares to the laziness, stupidity, and dullness of German violinists. Every fortnight, another one comes to me wanting to play the first concerto. I have now become rude and have told them I cannot listen to that concerto anymore. Did I just write the one? Go away and play the other concertos, which are just as good, if not better." But nobody agreed with him on that point. Everybody thought the first concerto.
You have no control over it once you release it to the wild.
Yes. And so, and the real tragedy of the whole thing is that he never even made any money from it. I mean, it was his first one, and he sold it for a small one-time fee to a publishing house that made a fortune selling the rights to it all over the world. He eventually sold the manuscript, the original handwritten manuscript, to a couple American sisters, piano-playing sisters, who insisted they were going to take it back to New York and sell it. And he never heard from them again and died. Eventually, the manuscript turned up in an auction from the estate of Mary Flagler Carey, who's the heir to the Standard Oil fortune, and can now be found at a museum in New York City at the Morgan Library. So he never made any money from it, and ultimately hated it, even though it represented the pinnacle of what he wanted to do in his career. Now, how this connects?
I trust you on this.
So I moved to New York City after grad school, as I had always dreamed to do. It was 2004, and I moved there. And my first month in the city, I was living in this apartment in Queens, looking for a more permanent apartment. And I had found one a more permanent apartment. And at the end of the month, I had this awkward day where I had to have all of my stuff out of my sublet in Queens in the morning, but I couldn't move into my new apartment until the evening. So I put everything in my car and went to work and came back, and the car was empty. Everything had been stolen. So all of my clothes, all of my books, and my computer, on which everything that I had written in grad school had been saved, and also, you know, all the CDs that I had backed up the computer on. So mm-hmm. I had packed them stupidly right next to the computer.
And you had no archive.
No, and the cloud didn't exist then. So here I was, dreaming to move to New York City my entire life to become a writer, and suddenly this happens. I lose everything, including all of my writing. You know, it was devastating. You know, and there's a real direct line between that moment and me writing The Knicks, because I had been working on a novel, at least a manuscript. I'm not sure if it would have been a novel, but I had been working on a manuscript, and I just couldn't keep working on it. It was too sad, and so I started a new piece, and it ended up being The Knicks. And one of the through lines in The Knicks is this story, this old folklore tale from Norway, which is where I got my title. A nix is in the Norwegian version of the telling, a nix is a kind of water spirit that will appear to young children as a white horse and tempt them to climb aboard. And if they do, it'll run them into the water and drown them. And it's kind of a story about, like, be careful what you wish for, you know. For the kids, they must have been ecstatic at seeing their having suddenly their own horse. But then, of course, tragedy strikes. Mm-hmm. And the moral kind of seemed to me that sometimes the things you want the most can also hurt you the worst. And so all of my characters are going through that because I went through that, you know. The what I wanted the most in the world was to move to New York City and become a writer. And that was a disaster, you know. All of my writing was stolen. And it turned out, like, New York City was extraordinarily hard to live in, especially At the time I was writing, I was working at a poetry nonprofit. So you can imagine what my salary was.
Yeah, that doesn't jive with you got to go way out of the city to live on that.
Oh, yeah. So it was really, really difficult to make a living. It wasn't exactly what I had expected, and this awful thing had happened. New York was my Knicks. You know, it was this thing that I had my eye on for a long time that ended up being punishing when it actually happened. And for Max Bruch, this concerto was his. You know, this was the thing that he had always wanted to accomplish. And then once he did, it was a disaster, unexpectedly, accidentally. And so I ended up putting this piece in the novel. In the novel, there's a young violin prodigy who plays a concerto, and this is the piece she plays.
You know, I read your novel, and I knew there was a violin prodigy in it, and I knew she played a song, and I imagined it in my head when I read the novel, but it wasn't until right now that I realized that was it.
Yep, it was this song. And I don't mention in the novel the whole story behind the song, mm-hmm. the whole kind of one-hit wonder aspect of it. It's just
wow,
one of those it's just one of those Easter eggs that if anybody cared to do a little research, they would maybe see the connection or listen to this podcast and I'll just do it for you.
When did classical music come along in your life? Sounds like, you know, your arc wasn't really heading toward classical, but, you know, in 2001 anyway, had classical entered your life then, or is it because of your wife?
It was only because of my wife. Yeah. She introduced me, and she introduced me to it at a time when I was in grad school, and I was really thinking about you know, plot development. I was thinking about story. I was thinking about through line and theme, and she was able to talk about all those things, but from a musical point of view, which was really very interesting. How does a composer take a theme and then develop it in the first movement, in the second movement, in the third movement? How does this musical material come back? You know, that's thinking about it musically is actually really helpful for a novelist, because if you're writing something that's long, and my novel is very long, you kind of can't pull the same moves over and over. You really have to make it dynamic. You have to really switch it around. And what she was able to tell me about music in terms of, you know, dynamic range, about going loud to soft, about refusing to end a phrase where the listener thinks you're going to end it, about creating suspense within measures. That was really helpful for a writer.
Absolutely.
And so I started listening to a lot of classical music, not only because she told me to, but also I found it very, very helpful for my own development in my craft.
What instrument does she play?
She plays the bassoon.
And she's been with the symphony for 15 years
yes,
or something,
has.
You
yeah,
said?
That's wow. right. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. We only have a few minutes left, but let's talk about live music. Do you have a live music experience that is your, you know, your pinnacle at this point in life? Is there something – or just the one that you loved the most, that you remember best?
I do. I have one. I was maybe a sophomore in high school, and my friends and I was living in Wichita, Kansas. And my friends and I, we got tickets to a Pearl Jam concert, and it was the day before Thanksgiving. So we all showed up in our long hair and flannels and combat boots, you know, and we go to the Pearl Jam concert. This, incidentally, was the first and only time I've ever crowd surfed at a concert. I noticed all these people near the mosh pit. Because there was a mosh pit, would turn to the person behind them and kind of give them a thumbs up gesture, and then that person would kind of boost them onto the crowd, and then the crowd would lift you up, you know, and carry you for a little while until they stopped being interested in that, and then you just kind of fall on your tailbone. And so I did that, which was thrilling. And at some point in the concert, Eddie Vedder, the lead singer of Pearl Jam, stops, and he's just like, he's so cool, you know, he's up there. He's just like, you know, tomorrow you're all going to go have Christmas – or not Christmas. You're all going to have Thanksgiving dinner with your family. And we're all like, boo. And he says, yeah, tell them I said to screw you too, or something like that. And we all cheered, and I cheered, and I was like – I was really into the moment, even though – I was really actually looking forward to Thanksgiving dinner. I really like Thanksgiving dinner, and you know, but like in the moment, you know, there's just something about like just being really angry for some reason that was delicious, you know. So I was booing just and cheering just with everybody else, and it was fantastic.
If you had to listen to only one album henceforth, what would it be? Like the whole I'm on an island and I only have one album.
Yeah. I think it's probably a tie between the aforementioned OK Computer mm-hmm. and probably the White Album, the Beatles. Mm. Yeah, that's a great – talk about variety. Talk about, you know, dynamic range, going soft aloud to soft aloud. You know, that's a great one.
You know, I think we've recorded like 11 of these now, and I think that the Beatles have made it into every one.
Is that right?
And you just snuck it in.
Yeah, just barely, just under the wire.
okay, well, any final thoughts?
No, thank you so much. This has been really, really – really fun. Has anybody asked you a question?
Not yet.
So take us out. What's your if you're you know home alone and you want to sing along to a song, what would it be?
The drinking song by Moxie Fruvis.
Oh, can you sing a bar to take us out?
No.
I tried, folks. I really tried.
And the band played on. Okay, that's as far as we get. Okay, I want to thank my guest, Nathan Hill, Naples resident and author of The Knicks, which I highly recommend. I might have to reread it now that you've explained that. Nathan, thanks so much for doing this. It's been a real treat.
Yeah, thank you.
We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University. The show is produced, directed, and co-created by Richard Chin Kui. Our online content producers are Tara Callaghan and Anna Bejarano. Our executive producer is Chris Duffus. Our theme music was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Before this week's parting tune, I want to ask listeners to send us your best song story. Just record your story about a particular song onto your phone and send the recording to mystory@threesongstories.org. We're going to be picking some favorites and start using them as parting tunes at some point in the not-so-distant future. But this week, my parting tune is from Bob Dylan. I came to Dylan relatively late in life, not till I was in my late 20s. My girlfriend at the time, Elise, was a big fan, and we spent a lot of time lounging around high on life and potentially a few other things, listening to his discography. 'Twas glorious times. His album Blood on the Tracks rose to the top of my list of favorites. I love every single track on that album, but today we're going to hear track number one. This is Tangled Up in Blue by Bob Dylan from his 1975 album Blood on the Tracks. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening.
Next time on Three Song Stories.
I could be driving, he'd be in the back seat, in the baby seat, and I'd turn the song on, and I'd see his head bopping. If they played this song and it came over the intercom at Publix, he was going to dance.